Hello and welcome to episode 17 of Once Upon a Nightmare. I am your host Lorraine and I'm here to discuss the horrors of the world, be it fictional or real. This week I am going real as I discuss one of the most extraordinary stories I've ever heard and a story of what a person will do to survive. This is the story of survivor Alison Botha. Can I just say before I go forward, it is a very distressing story, so I thought I'd just give you a little heads up there. Alison Botha survived a brutal attack on December 18, 1994. Alison was abducted by two men in Port Elizabeth, South Africa, and subjected to a brutal attack where she was raped, stabbed, disemboweled, and partially decapitated. Alison was born on September 22, 1967 in Port Elizabeth. Port Elizabeth is a city on Aloga Bay in the Eastern State Province of South Africa. Alison grew up with her mother Claire, father Brian, and elder brother Neil. Alison's parents were divorced when she was only 10 years old, with both children living with their mother. Alison was well respected at school and had leadership qualities that were spotted from an early age. In 1985, she would become the head prefect for Colgate High School for girls. She would do a one-year course at Port Elizabeth Technicon and then work in the city for 3 years. Alison would then leave South Africa to work in London. She would also travel the world. Once she was finished with her travels, she decided to return back to her hometown in South Africa. When Alison was 27, she would endure one of the most heinous attacks that would forever change her life. On December 17, 1994, Alison had a wonderful day with her friend Kim and Kim's sons, Devon and Jared. At Kim's flat, two friends decided to join them, Richard and Phil. Not wanting to end the night, they all decided to go back to Alison's flat. Kim went as Alison promised to drive her home later that night, and she did. On the early morning of December 18th, around 1 a.m, Alison turned into Deer Street in her yellow Renault 5, which she had named Reginald. When she returned home, she was unable to park directly outside her home and therefore looked elsewhere. It was an area that had trouble with finding a place to park. Even so, she managed to secure one under a tree. Unfortunately, due to the light being further up the street, it was quite dark and visibility was poor, but she parked there anyway. What happened next would be the beginning of a real-life horror story for Alison. A young, blonde, scrawny man appeared at her car door, brandishing a knife. He pressed the cold blade to her neck, forcing Alison to move over in her seat, stating he would kill her if she didn't comply. After the man got in and they pulled away, Alison wrestled with whether to make a jump for it or not, but didn't feel she could take that chance. As he made conversation with her, it became apparent that he'd been watching her as he told her, "You live at number one, don't you?" This made Alison wonder why she hadn't seen him, as he had obviously been lurking about. He then asked her, "What's your name?" She lied and said Susan. He said he was Clinton. Up until this stage, the abductor had told her he only wanted the car. The fact he only wanted the car and not let her go would send alarm bells ringing. After a few back and forth questions, Alison asked to be let out of the car and he could take it. He refused. He wanted company as he was looking for a friend who had stolen his television. After his refusal to let her go, Alison thought she saw her chance of escaping on spotting a police van. Unfortunately, her abductor also spotted the van. This made him slow down and the van drove away. As they carried on, the abductor started to become irritated. As they drove on, they soon reached a busy spot where there were hordes of people. He slowed down, muttering, "Where the fuck is he?" Unable to see his friend, he became even more irritated. He then drove on and the crowd began to thin out, only for him to return back and spot a man. A short young man dressed in black approached the car. His name was Thens. The abductor pulled his seat forward and the other man climbed in. As she looked in the rear mirror, she could see the man looking back at her. She described his eyes as dead, and in that moment, she knew she wasn't going to be going home. The two men spoke for a bit before heading off into the darkness, out of the city, with no cars and no people in sight. Alison just kept her eyes on the road ahead. The car was silent apart from the sound of the engine and the puff of a cigarette. As the journey went on, Alison was unable to keep her thoughts at bay. She wanted to know at least what was going to happen to her, so she could prepare herself. The not knowing was becoming unbearable. Soon the abductors veered off towards a beach. Alison could feel the soft sand on the tyres. The car almost got stuck, but they managed to free it after some frantic reversing. For clarity now, I will be using their actual names. The car came to stop and Thens got out. As Alison and Clinton sat in silence, she then asked, "What now?" "But I thought you would have realised. We want sex." "No," replied Alison. Alison was almost a bit annoyed at herself for not thinking this was on the cards, but she began to brace herself for what was about to happen to her. She could see Thens in the distance and said he almost looked bored. It was here when Clinton asked, "Are you going to fight?" and Alison said she would not. She thought up until this stage that as there had been no indication they intended to hurt her, that if she let them have sex with her, that would be that. That she could let them do that. That she could handle that. Alison was ordered to take her clothes off and perform oral sex on Clinton. He then directed his attention to her body. Alison spoke of the violation, how she could see him doing things to her and how revolting it was. He then tried to kiss her, stinking of nicotine from his cigarettes. When he began to rape her, Alison's body was prepared. At the time, Alison felt her body was betraying her, but she later found out that this is a natural thing to happen. It does not mean that you are turned on by what is happening. Alison kept saying to herself, "It is my body, not me." Once he was done, he asked Thens, "Do you want to have sex with this lovely lady?" Thens replied, "No, I want to fuck the bitch." Clinton told him he should not speak to her like that. She is a lady. After what he had just done, it was a bizarre thing to say, like he was defending her honour or something. As Thens started to rape Alison, he stopped himself and said he couldn't do it. As she sat there, naked and alone, Clinton began to doze off, and then she saw something terrifying. Thens was sat on the bonnet of the car, and to his side was a knife, a hunting knife, bigger than the one Clinton had used to abduct her. Alison began to get dressed as she watched Thens become restless. "Franz," he called out. So that was Clinton's real name. Now she had the real names of both her abductors. They then started to discuss on what to do next. She was ordered to undress again. Her jewellery was also taken, but at this point, Alison was thinking they would just leave her there, naked. She did manage to keep on her sandals, though, without either of them noticing. They had taunted her about whether to kill her or not, but at this stage, it appeared that they were playing some kind of cruel mind game. Then from out of nowhere, Franz was on top of Alison, trying to choke her. He had an empty, vacant look in his eyes as she stared into them. She asked him not to kill her. He simply replied, "Sorry." Alison then felt her bowels move. She felt embarrassment by this, and then she felt nothing. She had blacked out. They then stabbed her in her abdomen and pubic area around 37 times. Thens was the first to cut her throat, but Franz pushed him away and continued the attack, slashing her throat 17 times. She then came to slightly, as she was able to see them get up and walk away, get in the car and leave. As she lay there, believing she would die, she managed to write their names in the sand, Franz and Thens. She also wrote, "I love Mom." After everything she had just experienced, she wanted to make sure they couldn't do it to anybody else ever again. She soon felt a wet sensation. She realised her intestines were out of her body. They had thrown her clothes out of the car, so she used her denim jacket to hold in her intestines. She then managed to get up to walk and then realised that her head had flopped back. Her head was hanging off. She walked to the side of the road while holding her intestines by her stomach and her head held forward. She managed to make it to the road and collapsed. A car approached and slowed down. She was worried that it may be her attacker's back and then realised there was nothing she could do if it was them. It wasn't them, but they didn't stop to help her. They just drove off. Another car stopped and luckily a young man, Tien Ellard, got out with his friends to help her. Teens was studying to be a veterinarian. He had pulled over, ran to Alison, grabbed her hands and looked into her bloodshot eyes and told her she had nice eyes. Alison said he was her knight in shining armour. He then took off his shirt to cover her up. They had a mobile phone which was quite rare back in that time and they then called an ambulance. The ambulance would take quite a time to arrive. It didn't come for about 45 minutes. Teens asked the ambulance to go faster, but they felt there was no urgency. They felt she would not make it, so what was the point in rushing? When she arrived to the hospital, the doctor on duty, Dr. David Common, commented that he had never experienced such injuries on a person and how it had an impact on him. He could not believe that someone could do this to another person. Another doctor involved, Dr. Angelov, spoke of severe cruelty inflicted on Alison. The cruelty struck everyone involved in the hospital. When cleaning her up to start the surgery on her intestines, they commented on how there was so much sand and dirt that it all needed to be cleaned, and one doctor even took a scrub and brush to it. He cleaned her until she was clean. It was a long process. The doctor spoke of how they are men of science. They do not put things down to miracles. As she should not have survived, this was nothing but a miracle. It was the only explanation for them and everyone else. When examining her injuries, they did see that major arteries and organs were not damaged. With all the stab wounds, luckily they managed to miss them, which would have caused her to bleed out had they hit them. Two policemen soon arrived at the hospital, and when Alison woke up, they gave her a folder of pictures where she identified both attackers. Dr. Kahn was told, to make the case stronger, it would be good if Alison could verbalise the names rather than write them down. Horrified, he had to go to Alison to explain. Alison had a tube in her throat and was unable to speak. On hearing what was wanted from her, she told Dr. Coombe to remove the tubes. She wrote down, take it out. Her first words were, that's wonderful. And then she said, my attackers were Franz and Thens. After all her surgeries, Alison was transferred to the general ward, and that was the last time Dr. Coombe saw her. The recovery was far from over, though. Alison would have to visit the hospital many times and said it was just constant pain. All day and all night, there was pain. She rarely slept and felt it would never go away. The pain didn't stop there, as the police requested many pictures of what happened to Alison, and she would spend a lot of time having to pull down her trousers so they could get the pictures. While this was hard for her, she knew it needed to be done. One of the policemen involved, Melvin, spoke of how she never complained and just did what was asked of her. Alison wasn't the first to be raped by the two men. A woman reported the crime a week after it happened to her, and a second woman who was pregnant ran out of a house and straight into a police van. As the other two didn't fear the threats that Franz and Thens had made, they told the police that they decided that the next woman they got would need to be killed to silence her. When Franz was read his rights by Melvin, he was surprised to hear that he was being charged with attempted murder. He did not understand how she had survived. This soon shut him up. He simply said he might as well give it all up, as Alison will anyway. He then pulled a ring off his finger and gave it to the police officer, as it belonged to Alison. I'm not really going to go into who these scumbags were, and there is a reason for this. I don't think they're worth my airtime. The reason being, when the documentary was made on Alison, Franz was mentioned about being a part of it, and he had conditions, and the condition was, one, he received a letter from Alison forgiving him, and two, he wanted back pay from Alison's career. She had built a career for herself as a motivational speaker, but he said that if it wasn't for him, she wouldn't have that career. He is the reason that she is a success story. So therefore, he deserved to be paid. Luckily, the documentary told him to do one. So I'm going to do the same and not give him that time. Franz Dutoit was sentenced to 3 life terms without parole on August 7th, 1995. Thens Krueger was given 1 life term and 25 years with no parole. The judge, Chris Hansen, made a comment on the records that they were never to be released and that if there had been a death penalty, he would have given them that. He goes on to say that this case is the only one where he has actually made a note saying, don't free them. They are both still in jail, but a new parole law requires that people serving life are to be examined to see if they are eligible for parole. The thought of them getting out does terrify Alison, as she worries they might take revenge. Alison made the hard decision to not be angry, to not let the men control her life anymore. They took enough and they were to have no more of her. In an interview, the interviewee says Alison evokes a sense of peace and serenity. She dedicates her life to helping others who have experienced harrowing ordeals. Alison also explains how there are good men out there, how many have helped her, starting with Tian literally after it happened and his friends. As for Alison now, she is doing well. She's an inspiration. She went on to have 2 boys after being told that having children most likely would never happen. She also married. Her marriage did not last, but she is grateful for her children. Tian, her saviour, became a doctor rather than a vet and was actually present at the birth of her 2nd son. She loves being a mother. Alison went on and still does have a great career as a motivational speaker. It may not have been the life she planned, but she has made something amazing out of something so awful that happened in her life. This life she has now is down to her and what she has made of it. The brutality of this case and the level of cruelty affected all involved. When watching the documentary, you can see it still does get to everyone. The police, the lawyers, judge, friends, doctors, etc. This case has left a mark and will forever be with them. I would recommend watching the documentary on Amazon Prime. It's called Allison. And you really get a sense of who this woman is. And also there's an amazing moment at the end where she's reunited with some of these people. And it truly is wonderful. But I will leave you with this from Allison. On the night of the attack, she may wanted to die, but Botha got up because, and I quote, "I was worth fighting for." And that is the amazing story of Allison Botha. Next, we have a podcast recommendation, and this is a great true crime podcast. I've checked them out myself and I do enjoy, but I shall let them tell you for themselves. And that podcast is The Shit Show, a half-ass true crime podcast.
Hey, I'm Talisa.
And I'm Sarah.
We're the hosts of The Shit Show,
a half-assed true crime podcast.
Yeah, we're two moms who sit around chatting about true crime.
Each week, we cover lesser-known cases and talk about the shit shows that are our lives.
You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Play, and pretty much on any other platform that you would listen to a podcast.
You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Shit Show TCP.
Hey, bye.
Hey, bye.
Make sure you go follow them on all the social medias and have some downloads, listen, rate and review, and give them 5 stars. They totally deserve it. But anyway, I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode. And don't forget to rate and review on iTunes. I really do appreciate all the feedback, and I've had some really nice comments. And I appreciate all the support everyone's given with following, liking, retweeting, you know, all that jazz. Anyway, but if you want to find me on more places, you can get me on Instagram as Once Upon a Nightmare Podcast, Twitter and Letterboxd as A Nightmare Pod, email as onceuponanightmarepod@gmail.com, WordPress and Facebook as Once Upon a Nightmare. And you can also find me on my other podcast called Show Me the Podcast, where I talk about film and TV with my best mate. So you can go and check me out there as well. Anyway, I'd like to say thanks for listening, and I will chat to you next week with a movie. I'll chat to you soon. Bye-bye.